get your attention. We'll go ahead and get ticked off. Try to wake that back row up a little bit.
Okay, maybe I'll just sit here.
We haven't met for a while, so he's really excited. Yeah.
Appreciate everybody being here today, and especially our RAC members. We haven't met for a while, so it's kind of it's summertime. A lot of people have a lot of stuff going on right now, so appreciate them taking time out of their schedule to be here, and you too. Let's introduce ourselves. Start on this end over here.
Tim.
Yeah, with Tim.
No, Tim. Andrea Merrill. What am I? Non-consumptive. So.
Mitch Hacking, Agriculture.
Brett Prevedel, at large.
Randy Durth, Sportsman.
Boyd Blackwell, Division of Wildlife.
Dan Abeda, Forest Service.
David Gordon, BLM.
Daniel Davis, Sportsman.
Pass Andrea's name tag down. She obviously sat in the wrong place.
Well, no, she's in the right place.
I left point.
I asked her to watch out for Mitch down there. So, are we connecting?
Yeah,
where everything's going good? All right.
All right. Let's start off by approving of the agenda and the minutes. Do we have a motion to do that?
I motion that we approve the minutes and the agenda.
Thank you. Any second?
I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. It's unanimous. Well, let's have a Wildlife Board update. I've got a little bit to report since our last one. On the antler sub-permit recommendation that was made, the Wildlife Board approved that 6-0. And they want to thank the Northeast Region for our discussion on August 1st as to the survival of the calves orphaned from that August 1st to August 15th time frame. That was something that they hadn't, I guess, totally considered too. So they appreciated that discussion that we had here and to bring that to light. As far as the CWMU antlerless recommendation, there was a motion to accept that as presented, and it was passed unanimous also, 6-0. As far as the CWMU variance requests, there's a motion to approve that as presented, and it was it passed 5-0 with one abstention. The Hunter Education Rule Amendment was passed also 4-1. There was one in opposition to that with one abstention. The Antelope Island Cooperative Agreement to Revisions, it passed 5-0. That was the ability to hunt mule deer and bighorn sheep, one license in public draw for each and one license in the conventional pool for each of the conventional pool. There was an update on the Mexican wolf for Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. Basically, keep them in their historical range in Mexico, not in this neck of the woods. It's headed in a very positive direction, at least at that point. It was headed in a very positive direction. I'm not calling a report to us what was at that meeting. So basically, keep them in Mexico and not move them northward. Welcome, Tim. Appreciate you coming.
Sorry I'm late.
No problem. Let's see. Let's see if there's anything else. Okay, the Bucks Bulls Once in a Lifetime, the general season and deer permits. There's a little bit split there, the difference between the Southeast Region vote of no on that and the tag increase and division recommendation of 550 tags and in the Manti and San Rafael areas. The motion was passed 5-1. The general season deer permits for Pine Valley and Zion, that one passed 4-2. The youth any bull general season elk permit, there was a the youth where the youth can draw this tag once in a lifetime. There was a motion to add 300 tags to the youth any bull hunt, and that motion failed 2-4. That was the one that three of the RACs had voted in support of that out of five RACs. The Wasatch Elk, which is to leave the limited entry tags at 760 and not raise to the 804 as proposed by the division. That motion carried 3-3 with the vote by the chairperson had to do the tiebreaker on that one. And I think that's all I have as far as the that particular wildlife board meeting goes update. Any questions? I couldn't answer them, but I just curious if there's any questions. All right, we'll turn the time over for our regional update to our supervisor.
Great. It has been a long time since we've been here together. Seems like I'm just getting to know some of you guys again. First off, we have a new outreach manager. And that, I'm really happy to say that. If you remember back in May, Ron Stewart retired, and which put us into a search mode. And so, and after a long and intense interview process, we started with 151 applicants for that job. And we had a lot of people putting in for it. And I'm happy to announce that we selected Tanya Kiefer as our new outreach manager. I believe she'll do a very good job. And hoping she gets the opportunity out with the folks in our region. And if you have any questions regarding outreach, you can direct them her way. Kiefer. K-I-E-F-E-R, I think. Yeah. Not bad for someone who can't spell dog. So, you know. But, yeah, it was a very long and intense process. Really wore us out. Henry, with regards to some of our aquatic stuff, our invasive species, we've had no issues to date. We've had several check stops. We've got some coming up in the very near future. In fact, I received the plan for one. I forgot the date. I think it's this Friday, but I'm not sure. We've had no real issues, so that's been really good. A lot of compliance, which is even better. A little report on our red fleet. You've heard me talk a little bit about it over the last little while. All of the species that we identified in the management plan that we're going back into red fleet have been put in since December, and we're finding all of these species represented throughout the reservoir in a lot of different places. So we're really excited to see that. We've completed two nights of netting and electrofishing out there, and we put in 1,000 perch that came from Fish Lake, and they produced thousands of offspring. Just we caught them before they were to spawn, and they've really taken well out there. They appear to be in the 3 to 4 inch range right now. We put in 144 black crappie, and they've also produced, and their production is 1.5 to 2 inch range. So that is also showing very well. Our sterile walleye that we've put in, they're up to between 2 and 5.5 inches, and we're found to be utilizing the fat head minnows that we put in out there as a prey base. So they're utilizing those. Our wipers, they're abundantly found lake wide. And they were planted in April at about 10 inches, and they're up to 14 and a half inches already. So that's really cool. I'm really excited with the efforts of that of our aquatic section in what they they've done with Red Fleet, our next big project that you'll hear me talking about off and on is going to be, I know it's going to come to me.
What's the name of that reservoir out there?
Pelican, there we go. I know Pelican well. I fished there quite a bit, but I don't know why it drew a blank. And then when you lose it, I panic and go, I couldn't even tell you what your name was if I start to panic. So anyways, the aquatics guys are doing really good. Our habitat section have been really busy, again, installing more guzzlers, and they've been working on some mechanical habitat improvements around the region. So they've been really, really busy. Our wildlife section, you should know about this, and you may have heard it on the radio, and hopefully we'll be reading it. We've put out a press release, but our wildlife section will be holding an open house on August the 15th. So that's coming up fairly soon. And basically, I'm going to read the press release to you, to Vernal. It says, you can learn the latest about the deer herds in the northeastern Utah and share ideas about how to manage them at an open house on August the 15th. The open house will be held in Vernal at the Division of Wildlife Resources office. So it'll be held here. And we hope you'll attend, says, I'm not going to read that part. But the open house will be a great opportunity for you to learn more about the herds and share ideas with the biologist. It's going to start at 6 o'clock. And Dax will have his biologist there. And they'll share information about how the deer are doing on each of the deer units in the region. And after the presentation, we hope that we're hoping that the public will mingle and visit with the biologist and discuss deer herds with them. We're looking to our population objectives for each of the units, habitat conditions, and specific problems or issues are items the biologists want input on. So we're hoping that the people will come and do that. At this time, they're not looking for input about items that have already been finalized in our statewide management plans. And that information often includes specific hunt strategies, season dates, and lengths of hunts. Those items, as I said, just said, have already been finalized in for the next 5 years. So I'm hoping that the word will get out. If you know of anybody who's interested, please have them come, and if you forget the information, have them call the division office and Rory, and we'll help you. Now then, I want to introduce you to our front desk help that we've just recently hired.
He's standing for you to say.
Oh, her name's Terry. And Terry, just wave to everybody if you would. Terry is actually took over for Rory. and so those two have kind of just, she took over and Rory moved in to take over for Gail. Okay, so now I've started. I will never remember
take over what Gail did.
I think it's Oldheimer's. I don't think it's panic.
That's what I've got for you tonight. I'm going to quit right now. So I'll turn the time back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, thank you, boy. Appreciate that.
Whoa. That's horrible.
Go ahead and kick off meetings.
Wait, I'm sorry. I've just got, it was brought to my attention. We have a new CO here, too, and brand new in the region. Scott.
Cody.
Cody. No, I don't. I forget names, and once I forget one name, I'm not good for any more. So Cody's our new west side of the book clubs. And And Red Cloud, right? Doesn't your area go up Red Cloud out to the west side of the book class?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Cody, tell us your last name.
I'm Cody Jones. I've actually worked for the division for about 8 years. I've been down in the southern region this last 8 years. So.
Cool. Well, welcome. We appreciate you being up here.
Thanks, Cody. I think that's the last name I need to use tonight. So. Go now.
Okay, tonight's the Leslie show, so we're going to invite her to come up and give her first presentation. This is on the fur bearer rule amendments. We'll turn the time over to Leslie before I.
Yep, Leslie, I'll never forget you.
I've worked with Boyd for a long time, so if he forgets that, he's in trouble. Okay, so the first thing I'll go over is the fur bearer rule. And honestly, this rule probably hasn't been looked at since Boyd was the mammals coordinator about 20 years ago. So a lot of it is clerical changes. If you looked through it, there were a lot of red lines. So we went through and made a lot of clerical changes. So the only thing that I'll go over now are the changes that actually affect rules or the public. So just so you know, we got together with our regional biologists. We got together with the Houndsman Association and the Trappers Association and our law enforcement section and kind of went through the rule together to try and find some of the places where we might be deficient or need to fix a few things. So first section that I'll go over is just our bait section, or our definition section. Boyd's rubbing off on me. the first thing we changed was bait. And in our previous rule, it had a section. So right now, bait means any lure containing animal parts larger than 1 cubic inch. And then it had a requirement in there if you use a cubby set that you had to have at least a minimum of 8 cubic inches. We took that out because none of our law enforcement officers go out with a ruler and try and see if it's 8 cubic inches. So we consider bait anything larger than 1 cubic inch, with the exception of white bleached bones with no hide or flesh attached. We have added cage trap into the definition. That was not in there. Cage traps are becoming more popular for trapping fur bearers. And everybody knows what a cage trap is. They're just the one-way door with the treadle or the pan. Throughout the rule, every time it talked about a foothold trap, it listed every single type of foothold trap. So we've just said foothold trap means any of these things, and so we just defined them all up front. Under the Martin section, it also said it had a definition for good condition for a carcass, and so we just moved that up to the definition section. And then also throughout the rule, it defined owner, and it had a really long definition of what the owner of a trap was. And so we've just made it short and succinct. An owner of a trap is any person who has been issued a trap registration number associated with one or more trapping devices. Under the permanent tagging section, and this will make sense in a little bit when I go over the recommendations for bobcat. Last year, we moved the permanent tagging date for bobcat and martin to the first Friday in March. We're asking to now move that to the second Friday in March because we are going to ask for a request to extend the season on bobcats. So this will make it so that we never have an overlapping day of the last day to tag a bobcat and the closing day as well. So we're going to move that permanent tagging day. It also within the rule, it required that anyone that harvested a marten had to bring us the lower jaw in addition to the skin or the carcass when they were bringing it in for tagging. We do not use those jaws for anything, and so we've taken that requirement out. Under the disturbing or trapping portion of the device, there are other things in the rule that clarify, like a peace officer can move a trap or a device if they need to in the performance of their duties. We've added the landowner where a trap has been placed, especially if somebody didn't get permission to be on that landowner's property, or the owner of a domestic pet that has been caught in a trap may take their pet out of the trap. It has come up in other regions that, well, what if they take the trap? And I can say that there have been scenarios where somebody that has no idea what a trap is and doesn't even know how to open them will have to take their animal in a trap somewhere to have somebody help them get the trap off. In some cases, people aren't strong enough to open the jaws of the trap. And so we're, if they take it, we hope they bring it back. One thing that we did add after working with our law enforcement and things, a lot of people want to try and use roadkill or vehicle kills for kind of as a bait, but not really a bait. But they want to put traps near a roadkill. So we did add this portion because before it was prohibited to use any kind of protected wildlife as a bait. So we've added traps may be placed near the carcass of protected wildlife provided the carcass has not been moved or relocated for the purpose of trapping wildlife and the trap is not located within 30 feet of the carcass. We don't want traps too close to carcasses so that we don't accidentally catch raptors or eagles or things like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. You know, we didn't talk about these cards. It'd be a good time to talk about that. If anybody would like to present one, please give us one of these cards. You can fill those out now if you'd like. Questions by the rack.
About the traps near carcasses, near roadkill, is that's becoming more and more common? Is that?
Well, we have people that want to take advantage of a carcass that's out there, and technically it's illegal to use that to put your trap near it because it's protected wildlife. And so we're just making it so that if it's out there, you can use it, but you can't move it or relocate it.
Knowing how the martin are doing on the UNIS with the trapping?
Randall, do you have a way of knowing how the martin are doing on the UNIS?
I mean, they're catching quite a few, aren't they?
They actually are. We see them very, very consistently. Things like that. We don't have a real trend count or anything that we get to do with them because they're so elusive and that kind of stuff. But yeah, they actually seem to be doing quite well.
Your gut feeling is they're expanding?
Yeah. The trappers are catching, caught them in new. Every drainage now that we have across the UN, seen them, they're catching in places we haven't seen them caught before every year and that kind of stuff too. So they seem to be doing quite well. There's not a huge interest in the trapping of martins. Of course, there's literally probably 10 or 15 people who come each year, which probably will be average, but every year we'll get a couple of new people to come in and know someone new and they'll trap them and be successful. So I think the martin are actually doing very well.
Yes.
Where does snares fit into all this?
As far as...
Are they a trap? Are they?
Yeah, they're in the fur bearer rule. So I didn't put anything up that's already in, that we're not changed. So this is only changes.
Just on the traps.
Yeah.
What? Another question. What kind of the overall trend of you know trapping? I guess in this region or statewide is it? Is it down or is it stable?
So the Trappers Association president couldn't be here. He was in the Southeast region, and he's been in the other ones with me. And that question was actually asked last night. They are seeing an increase in participants in the Trappers Association, and they are working on trying to recruit youth and things like that. I know that they were at the expo, the big wildlife expo, and he said that they had a lot of interest in people that signed up to become the members. The thing that they're having a hard time finding are people that want to be fur harvest educators. And so if you know anyone with interest, they're looking for people.
A lot of the interest in the last few years, it cycles. It's kind of cycling depending on the price of pelts. Bobcats got very, very high 2 years ago and last year, and it's
now kind of dropped back off again. And so the interest kind of tracks the dollar value that's there.
Any other questions by the RAC? Questions by the public?
I didn't have a question. Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason. Okay. Comments by the RAC? Do they have any comments? Well, that discussion. Anybody have any concerns?
No. I'll ask. I got a question. I had one of my dogs get in a trap on Brush Creek. I wasn't there. It was one of our hands seeing it. Apparently, they said it was an illegal trap. I guess, is a trap set inside a box where they can put their head in it, is that illegal? If we got a question, I guess the thing to do is call the DWR and find out about it, I guess. Huh? What are the type of illegal traps that you see the most of?
So some things are like taking a bucket and putting bait in the bottom of a bucket so that, and that's the way most dogs get caught, is when they stick their head in a bucket.
This was some type of a box, and bait was in it, and then I had a snare and the hole going in the box. And that is an illegal trap, right?
Yeah, so there are cubby sets, and those are a little different. They're set up different, but just taking a bucket out and setting a trap inside the bucket is an illegal set. So that's kind of the same thing that you're describing.
So I guess if you got any questions, just get a hold of the DWR.
Yeah, they like those kind, actually, of cases.
Cubby sets are kind of put at an angle, so birds
and they aren't set above ground, right?
Does that make sense? So it's kind of at an angle. So usually you'll dig the bank out a little bit and set it back in to kind of protect the trap from the dirt.
Yeah, thanks, Clint.
There wasn't much left of that trap after I told you guys to get hold of it. So, arrest me. Well, I think it was the illegal trap.
If it was on your land without your permission.
But they are out there, illegal traps. So.
Yeah.
They are out there.
Any other RAC discussion? Well, we'll entertain a motion.
I'd make that motion that we accept this as presented.
I'll second it. Brett made the motion.
David.
Thank you, Dave. David Gordon. David Gordon made the second. You had that, Rory. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
It's a rough night tonight.
Seven in favor, no opposed. Thank you. Well, Leslie, you're up again for the Bobcat.
Okay, so the next item I have for you is the Bobcat Management Plan. The Bobcat Management Plan is not a plan that is required by rule, law, or statute. It's something that the division put in place to protect the bobcat species from overtrapping and overharvest. And so we've put in place some metrics to try and estimate survival and that type of thing so that we know when to cut back on season lengths and trapping days, or permits, I'm sorry. So a little bit of history. The plan was approved in 2007. It's set to expire this year. It was prepared by a Bobcat Working Group, which consisted of representatives from the Division of Wildlife, the Trappers Association, the Houndsman Association. There was a RAC member, some academia representatives, and some representatives from the non-consumptive community. It's set to expire here, where it's not a plan that's required by rule or law. We want to put in here that it will undergo an internal review every 10 years. and that we'll bring it back out if things are not working well with it. And so I'm not going to put an expiration date on this one. We did do an internal review with it. We did invite some law enforcement, some of our biologists, and we did consult with the Trappers Association and the Houndsmen Association. So the purpose of the bobcat management plan is to direct the management of bobcats to assure the future of the species through protection, propagation, and management. While considering bobcat distribution and the intrinsic scientific, educational, and recreational values for the citizens of Utah. Our goal is to maintain a healthy bobcat population with an existing suitable habitat and provide quality recreational opportunity for bobcat harvest while considering the social aspects of bobcat harvest. Our population objective is to maintain current statewide distribution with a reasonable proportion of older age animals. In the previous plan, there were four performance targets. And so I'll just go over the targets. We kept them the same except for we did remove the fourth. So let me just go over those with you. One is to look at the proportion of kittens and yearlings in yearling animals in the harvest. And what the way this was figured is they took our long-term historical trends and picked the middle of that for how populations were doing, when populations were doing well. And so they've picked a range, and we want it to be within that range. If it goes outside of that range in a positive direction for population growth, that's really good. If it's below that range in a negative direction for population growth, that's bad. So our proportion of kittens and yearling animals in the harvest that we'd like to see is between 0.42 and 0.56. You want to see yearlings in your harvest because that indicates that your population is recruiting animals in. And then the next metric that we look at is our adult survival. This is based on tooth ages from the lower jaw that we collect. The range that we'd like to see is about 0.65 to 0.72. And then our percent females in the harvest, similar to cougar, you don't like to have a lot of females in the harvest because that indicates that you can have effect on the population. Historical range that was chosen for this is between 0.41 and 0.45. The fourth metric that was in the previous plan was set days per bobcat, and that's actually not a biological metric at all. It's based on information that we collect from our survey. And it can be based on experience. It could be based on all kinds of different things. It could be based on what somebody reports. And so it really has no biological indication on what a bobcat population is doing, and so we've removed that as a performance target. So our strategy, our baseline strategy for bobcat management is to maintain baseline, which is 6 permits per individual. We'd like the season to run from the third Wednesday in November to March 1st. Now, this is an expansion of the date that used to end toward the end of February. I looked at all of the western states, and all of the western states are consistent. They end about the first part of March, the end of February. So we're moving the season to be consistent with other states. And then no cap on the number of permits. So we'll maintain baseline strategy if 2 or more of the variables are within the historical range in a outside the historical range in a positive direction for population growth. We'll maintain baseline. If 2 or more of those variables on the other page are outside the historical range in a negative direction for population growth, then we'll make a recommendation to decrease the number of permits per individual by 1 or 2. If the next year we come back and the data still looks similar and it's still within the same ranges in a negative direction, we'll keep the season the same. If it continues to decrease, then we'd request a further reduction in the number of permits available per person. Same thing with season length. If 2 or more of the performance targets are outside the historical range in a negative direction for population growth, We would request to reduce the season by 1 to 2 weeks on the front end of the season, not on the back end of the season. And same thing here, if the next year the numbers came in within the same range, we would keep the season length consistent with the previous year. However, if it continued to be, if it was more negative than the previous year, then we would decrease it further. Now, if all three performance targets are outside the historical range in a negative direction for population growth, then the number of permits would be capped at 80% of the number of permits sold the previous year. So, for example, we sold 9,447 bobcat permits this past year. If we were to cap it, it would be 80% of that number. It would be first come, first serve. And this, the cap would be implemented in addition to the strategies of decreased permit and season length. Now, one of the things that was a concern in the last bobcat plan, we did have a cap on for several years. Things turned around and went back in a positive direction, and we jumped all the way back to baseline, and that was a concern for a lot of people. Who are very worried about overharvest and that type of thing when things were just starting to turn around. So after a cap has been implemented, the division may begin to increase season length and number of permits available per individual by 1 to 2 weeks or permits per year toward the baseline if the performance targets are moving back toward historical ranges in a positive direction for population growth. So if things start turning around, we can go back stepwise instead of jumping all the way back to baseline. There are some outreach and education parts of the plan that we went back through and clarified, and I won't go through all of these because there are a lot. But our first objective is to increase awareness and appreciation of the general public for the role of bobcats in Utah ecosystems. Working on developing educational programs on the role of predator and prey interactions in our ecosystems, and providing educational opportunities on the role and use of trapping and hounds in bobcat management. Our second objective is to maintain quality hunting and trapping opportunities for bobcat, primarily through promotion of ethical and legal hunting and trapping practices through the Fur Harvester Education Program, looking at developing incentives to help attract new fur harvest education teachers. We work with the Trappers Association and the Houndsmen Association. They have a monetary reward program for trappers or houndsmen that turn in somebody doing something illegal through their groups. Again, I won't go through all of those. Our third objective is to work on reducing conflicts between those involved in bobcat harvest, trappers and houndsmen, and other recreationists. So we try to promote the setting of traps and snares away from popular hiking and recreation sites, with the recommendation that they should not parallel established hiking trails. Encouraging houndsmen and trappers to avoid trapping or pursuing bobcats in urbanized or populated areas or popular recreation areas to avoid conflicts and possible capture of domestic pets. And recommending that trappers avoid using lethal sets when trapping in areas where they may catch a domestic pet. And then there is an objective in here addressing recreationists respecting both trappers and houndsmen. I'm not sure that they might read this plan, so there isn't a lot that way, but we do have that in there. We did identify some areas that we need some further research on bobcats, including population estimation, survival, population connectivity, and identification of sources and sinks. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Any questions by the RAC? Brett?
Do you treat the whole state as, for your numbers and statistics, the whole state as one unit?
Yes.
Yeah, Leslie, could you go back to your slide on the performance targets?
Yes.
The second one, I understood the first two, or one and three, but second one, adult survival. Could you go over that again?
Yeah, so what we do, every bobcat that's harvested, we require the trapper, the hunter, to bring in the lower jaw. And then we take a subsample of those to get our tooth ages. And then we use a Robson Chapman estimator. I look at Randall because he's the bobcat guy everywhere. But we use the Robson Chapman estimator to kind of estimate survival based on the ages that we find in the harvest. It does violate some things and some known assumptions, but it's the best that we can get out.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Another question. Mitch?
What makes a hide go from $70 to more than $500, $560 in the market?
A lot of it's just demand in the market at the time. People that are looking for those, it's just demand.
Other questions? Go ahead, Juicy.
I'm wondering, is there any way reasonably, requiring the trappers to mark or put a fence post or something, telling the general public that they have traps in the area? Mitch had dogs caught. I've had two dogs caught. In bobcat traps, and I had no notion that there were traps in the area. It's a little annoying to have your pets caught.
Right, and I completely get that, but there are a couple of factors there, and the reason that we haven't gone to there are actually some anti-trapping groups that are actually pushing for us to make that requirement. And the reason that we haven't done that is it does make traps more visible. And there is a large proponent of people that don't agree with trapping at all. And so we don't want to highlight that so that they get messed with, I guess. I mean, I understand the domestic pet thing. I do. It's just we're...
Do you feel like pointing out that there are traps in the area because anti-people...
Yes. Yes, we have had some incidents in the southeastern region not that long ago where some animals were purposely put into snares and pictures were taken, and it just to promote that type of thing. And so we try to avoid advertising it.
A big problem we run into with trappers also is trap theft. A lot of our trappers lose traps every year to theft by just the general public and other trappers. And so a lot of them don't want to have to mark where their traps are because the odds of them being stolen are so much higher. And a $10, $15 a trap, that's a big investment for them, you know, if they get a lot of money.
I'm not saying that it couldn't happen in the future and it might come into play in the future, but for now we're not asking for that.
Other questions? The public motorbike. Okay. Comments by the public. Director of the rack. Comments? Comments by the public? I haven't come in cars, but. Well, we'll entertain a motion then.
I'll go ahead and make a motion that we accept the plan as presented here tonight.
Great.
I'll second it. I'll second the motion.
Dan made motion and Mitch seconded. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Unanimous, 7-0. Thank you. Leslie, you've got another one. This is on the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations. So that's the show.
It is. It's all about me. Okay, so now that we did the fur bear rule and the bobcat plan, I can do our recommendations for those species. Just a little bit of information on our bobcat harvest. And I don't know if there's a pointer here, but I'll try and point. So down the side are our total, the upper line there is the number of permits that we've sold by year since 2005. The bottom line there is our actual bobcat harvest. So if you look back to 2010 to 2014, we had a cap on the number of permits that were sold. You can see that in 2014, things turned around, and they released the cap on that, and we sold almost 14,000 permits. That being said, the harvest was not any higher than we had ever seen historically. I mean, it was higher in response to some of more tags, but it wasn't extremely high. So that is a good thing for us to know for the future if caps and that kind of situation arises again. But this past year, there were 9,447 tags that were sold. There were 2,338 bobcats that were harvested. Our primary means of harvesting bobcats is through trapping. Our trapping harvest was 1,683 versus 140 that were taken through hounds or other hunting harvest. This past year, there were 2,338 trappers, and that is down a little bit from last year, 2015. There were 2,578 trappers. So one of the metrics that we look at is the proportion of age and sex in our harvest. So if you look on the dark bars are male in the harvest, and then the lighter gray bar are the females in the harvest. And then if you look at the bottom, you can see the age in years. So what we do like to see, actually, is the second column over where we've got a lot of yearlings in the harvest. In particular, yearling males, because that does indicate population growth, and we like to see more males than females taken. So if that were opposite and we had those larger lines, say at 7.5, and the other ones were low, that would be a really bad thing for bobcats. So again, we look at the target ranges and our percent young. We like that to be between 42 and 56%. Our adult survival, we want that to be between 65 and 72%. And our percent females in the harvest, we want that between 41 and 45. So these are the last 3 years. 2014 and 15 are the first two columns. This last season is the last column up there. Our percent juvenile in our harvest was at 62%. That is outside of our target range in a positive direction for population growth. And then our percent survival based on our ages in our harvest was at 73. So that is also outside the historical range in a positive direction for population growth. And our percent female in our harvest is right within the range. It was at 44%. So based on that, we are, and again, our guidance from our bobcat plan is if two or more are within or outside in a positive direction for population growth, then we maintain baseline. So our recommendation is to allow 6 tags per individual, the season to run from November 16th to March 1st with no cap on the number of permits sold. And then our other fur bearer season dates, we're recommending they're in line with historical previous seasons. Beaver and mink from September 24th to April 5th. We are requesting to extend badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, weasel, and marten to go to March 1st. Because if we have people that are out there trapping for bobcat, it's possible to have incidental take of these other species, and we don't want to have somebody in violation. So we're moving all of the seasons to be consistent. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Questions by the rock?
Yeah, I've got one. On the badgers, if you get an area that's really being overrun with prairie dogs, would you consider backing off on the badgers? Do you ever take that into consideration?
Well, the one thing we don't do is regulate take by any area in the state. It's pretty much open statewide. If there was a concern, you could get with your regional biologists and we could look at doing some closures like we do with beaver if you had an area where you had an issue.
Because if you got any extra ones, I'll take them.
You hear that, guys?
I don't even care if they dig big holes, I'll tell you. They're a friend to a few of us farmers anymore, I'll tell you. But it's a statewide deal, and you never take an area and take that into consideration.
Not with the other fur-bearing species. We don't track those populations close enough in any part of the state to really put restrictions on it.
Individual badgers, Mitch, they move quite a bit. So even though you've got a lot of them, you know, it's really hard to try to target specific areas and try to protect those badgers. They rotate through a huge area where they move and things.
Well, you know, for instance,
you have to close a big area that they increase.
Say, for instance, you close down the Ouray Valley area, you know, to badger hunting.
Problem is, some of you would love to have us pull out, and some of the neighbors probably hate to have us leave it more, have more badgers in their backyards.
Would you show me some of those neighbors?
They aren't the ones you hang out with in coffee shop. They're a different bunch.
Do they cycle with the rabbits? Or do they have a prey that they coincide with, the populations of the bobcats? Or?
They're not as cyclic as like the bobcats are.
They
do to a degree as the abundance. I mean, everything, it's more weather probably pattern related than anything else. It's a trend, but nothing like
on the bobcat. On the bobcats.
The bobcats track with the rabbit population.
They do directly.
Yeah, badgers don't.
No, I was talking about bobcats.
Very tied to rabbits. No shares.
And by the way, right now we're kind of at a high for rabbits in our region. Probably 30-year high.
That's actually for the entire state. Rabbits are up.
Another question by the rack. Question by the public. Comments by the rack. No comment cards. Well, we'll entertain a motion. Or discussion. Any discussion?
I think they did the biologist did a good, Leslie guaranteed us when they took the cap off that there wouldn't be a wreck of the harvest, and it matched exactly what you told us 2 years ago would happen. So I commend you on that.
Thanks. That was a lucky guess.
We'll entertain a motion.
I motion that we accept the fur bearer and the bobcat harvest recommendations as presented.
David made the motion. Any second?
I'll second it.
Andrew second that. All in favor? Aye. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's unanimous.
Okay, you're almost done with me.
Cougar recommendations.
Alrighty, last thing for me. Just some reminders on historical cougar harvest. Cougar harvest in Utah has been managed under limited entry hunting since about 1999. In the mid-90s, there was a dramatic increase in the number of permits that were offered. In 1997, additional harvest pressure was added by switching some units to a harvest objective system. A record high of 1,496 permits were sold. And if I remember right, Boyd was the mammals coordinator at that time. since 2000, we've averaged about 321 limited entry or split permits and an average of 254 in our quota. This past season, we offered 495 permits or quota. It was broken out with 246 that were limited entry or split and 249 that were quota. Our total sport harvest was 371, with 45% of the permits filled during the limited entry season and 68% of the permits filled during the harvest objective season. So it's not hunter success because we didn't survey hunters. That's based on the number of permits that were filled from what we sold. Our total harvest, including wildlife services, nuisance, and vehicle kill, was 394 compared with 372 last year in 2015. And just to show you, so on this graph here, the upper line is our total harvest, including both male and female, and then the green line is our male harvest, and the orange line is our female harvest by year. And so what we like to do for cougar management is make sure that those two lines are not converging, because that means you're taking as many females as you are males, and it means you're affecting your population. So we like to see what you see in the trend since about 2006. We like to see those two populations diverge, or those two harvests by sex diverge. So again, in accordance with our cougar management plan, we look at the proportion of females to males in our hunter harvest. So this is the proportion of our harvest. So the light gray represents the male by year, and the dark gray is the female by year. You can see since about 2008, and then one more thing. So the dotted line there is the percent or the proportion of females in our harvest. In accordance with our plan, if you're under cougar management, we like proportion of female in the harvest to be below 40.40, and we like, if you're under predator management for, say, deer or bighorn sheep, then we want to see the proportion of females in the harvest above 0.40. So you can see since 2009, we have maintained female harvest on a statewide basis below that 0.40 threshold. The other thing that we look at in accordance with our cougar management plan is the percent of the harvest that is 5 years of age or older. And in accordance with our cougar management plan, we want to see at least 15 to 20% of the harvest on any of our units to be between 5 years, to be 5 years of age or older. On a statewide level, this past year, 40% of our harvest was at 5 years of age or older. And that's way above our metric in our plan. The other thing that we track when we look at cougars is the amount of livestock depredation. So the green line are the number of incidents. Incidents are defined as a livestock owner who has had cattle or sheep that have been taken by cougar, or in one case it was some goats, some turkeys, and six cats. But this past year, last year there were 34 incidents related to cougar. This year it went up to 60 incidents that were attributed to cougar. So we are seeing a bit more livestock depredation than we've seen in the past. This graph is a little bit wrong. After I met with Wildlife Services the other day, they have removed 24 cougars this year, and that right there is 12. So that's also up. The year before, they only removed 8 in response to livestock depredation. That's almost tripled for them. The other thing, we paid $148,000 out this past year for livestock depredation due to cougars and bear. $68,000 of that was attributed to cougar, and that is up by about $22,000 from the previous year, or $24,000 from the previous year. It was only $44,000 in 2015. So I'll go through each of the regions and just highlight the changes. I won't go through each of these unit by unit. I'll just give you a guideline to the table here so you know what we're referring to. So the left column is the unit. The second column over is whether or not that unit qualifies for predator management based on the cougar management plan, and what species it's under predator management for. The next column over are the number of permits that were the permits or the quota that were offered last year. The next two columns are the two main performance targets from our cougar management plan that we look at for making our recommendations. The other thing to remember is those are three-year averages. They are not single-year averages. So it's based on the performance over the past 3 years. If it's under cougar management, we want harvest of females to be below 40%. And if it's under cougar management, we want, again, the age structure of animals that are 5 or older to be between 15 to 20%. And then if it's predator management, we want the percent females to be over 40% because we're trying to decrease cougar populations in those areas. And then on those units, we don't consider age in the structure. So then the next column over are the recommended permits or quota. If it's in green, it's an increase from the previous year. If it's in blue, it's a decrease from the previous year. And then the strategies, none of the regions are recommending a change to any of the harvest strategies on any of their units except for in the southeast region, and I'll talk about that one. So for the northern region, it's an increase of 1 on the Box Elder Desert, the Cache, an increase of 2, Chalk Creek Camas, an increase of 2, East Canyon Unit, an increase of 2, the Morgan South Ridge, a decrease of 2, and the Ogden, a decrease of 1. In the northeastern region, they are not making any recommended changes to any of their units except for on the Wasatch Mountains Current Creek North. That unit, the three-year average for females is in the harvest is only 5%, and the age structure for the past 3 years, 50% of that harvest was 5 years of age or older. So they are recommending an increase in that unit by 2. For the central region, they're recommending an increase of 3 on the Central Mountains Nebo, an increase of 2 on the Oker Stansberry, the Wasatch Timpanogos, an increase of 2, Wasatch Mountains West Strawberry, an increase of 2, West Desert Mountain Range is an increase of 4, and West Desert Tintic Vernon, an increase of 2. The southern region, they're recommending a decrease of 1 on the Beaver Unit, an increase of 1 on the Fillmore Pavant, an increase of 2 on the Pine Valley North, an increase of 1 on the Pine Valley South, increase of 1 on the Plateau Fish Lake, an increase of 2 on Southwest Desert, and a decrease of 2 on the Zion Unit. Southeastern region, they're recommending an increase on the Central Mountains Northeast Manti of 3, the Southeast Manti, an increase of 3, the 9 Mile North, an increase of 2, and then the San Juan unit, they're requesting to split that unit into 2, and they're making a bighorn sheep portion of that unit to address some issues with bighorn sheep. And so that portion, it will be known as the San Juan Desert. It's primarily bighorn sheep, and so in accordance with our predator management portion of the cougar management plan, they're going to make that an unlimited harvest unit because that's the only prey source for cougars are bighorn sheep. The rest of the unit will be known as San Juan Mountains, and there's no change to that strategy. Just to show you where we sit with previous years, so for this next year, we're recommending a total of 223 limited entry or split permits. That's a little bit down from the previous year by seven, and then we're recommending 299 harvest objective quota totals. That's an increase of 12. So although you see that we move around and increase some units, it's not dramatic overall on a statewide basis. We are recommending one boundary change in the northern region. This is to make this boundary consistent with bighorn sheep and my mind just went blank. Bighorn sheep and elk. We have a memorandum. Boy, you're rubbing off. We have an MOU with the state of Nevada that a hunter that has either a cougar, an elk, or a bighorn sheep permit can hunt on the Nevada side in that boundary as long as they may obey Nevada's hunting laws and rules. And they have, we have a reciprocal thing where they can do that on the Utah side as well. Again, the only other the other boundary change we're recommending is to split the San Juan into the San Juan Desert and the San Juan Mountains units. Our season dates that we're recommending, our limited entry would go from November 9th to May 31st. Our split season limited entry would be November 9th to February 24th, with the transition to harvest objective on March 2nd and go through May 31st. Our harvest objective season would go November 9th through November 4th. Our unlimited quota, those are the bighorn sheep units, would be November 9th to November 8th. And our pursuit season would run November 9th to May 31st. So in summary, all the recommendations are in accordance with the Cougar Management Plan. All females, not just adult females, are considered in the harvest. Our age performance target is an extra measure on population performance. And a lot of the increases that you see on some of these units will should help address some of the livestock depredation concerns. A lot of those were on the Wasatch and the Manti. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Questions by the rack?
I've got one. In the northern region, you have your, you know, your deer, your bighorn, and or no, but you have one as other. I'm just curious what the other was.
So that the East Canyon Davis sits right above Bountiful, and we have a lot of cougars that like to come down into Bountiful. It kind of sits within the middle of the East Canyon unit, but it pretty much incorporates the Bountiful face and then just up on top of the mountain. And then on the other side, it's fine. It's just we try and keep cougars from coming into town there. So they maintain a heavy harvest right there.
Other questions?
You probably answered it. I had a question on your livestock depredation.
Uh-huh.
And I guess it was at the end, probably at the Wasatch Front and stuff. Is that where it was at?
That's primarily where a lot of the incidents were. I looked at where we paid out the most, and it was on those three units and some of the southern part of the state as well.
I was going to ask you what you thought caused it, but it sounds like maybe you just got a little too many animals.
We've got some increase probably in some cougar populations in some of those areas.
I just want to make sure so
yeah.
My eyeballs open.
Yeah. Yeah, Leslie, can you go over that where hunters can hunt both Nevada and Utah again?
Sure.
I'm kind of curious about that. I've never heard of that before.
We've had that MOU in place for a really long time, and the reason that we have that is the shape of the Pilot Mountains. It kind of goes over both states, and it's really hard for hunters to determine whether or not they're in Utah or Nevada. So we established that with them a really long time ago.
Four male and female harvest, can you go back there?
Exactly.
So is it possible, back to a little bit of Midge's question, where we had a higher female harvest last year that left some younger cougars around that have to prey on easier prey? Is any of that considered?
Well, I'm not seeing that in the harvest there. I mean, it was a little bit higher, but not enough to do. I mean, our male harvest is a lot higher than last year.
And then we're over 5-year-old harvest.
Okay. So some of this I attribute to that we had some snow in some of our southern region units that we haven't had for quite a long time, and so they were able to harvest some of these older animals that they haven't been able to get at for a long time.
Because the reason I asked that is, like, dry pork for our area, experienced that there was a female hit in the mouth of the canyon, and then the young were running all over town and being reported in yards, and goats were eaten, and things like that. So I have seen where when the young are left, they're going to eat what's the easiest to catch. And I actually helped on an incident like that last year over in Deep Creek, where there was a maned lion that couldn't prey on its regular prey. It actually ate a living several dogs.
I mean, we could go and we could look at... You can look at individual units to look at female harvest to see if there's any of that. But a lot of our nuisance stuff tends to be two-year-olds that come down into town. We haven't had a whole lot of kittens on the front.
Just get whipped out of their area and have to go make home somewhere.
Yeah, we get a lot of that along the front there.
Other questions by the rec?
Thank you.
Questions by the public? Comments by the rec? JC, I think we got a card for you. You got a comment? You would stand up in the mic, state your name for the recorder there.
Hello. Yeah. There we go. JC Brewer. Hey, Professor, can you go back to that slide where you're showing the Bookcliff unit?
The which one?
Bookcliff. Right there. Okay, you're recommending no change in a harvest objective hunt. As a deer hunter, I've been advocating for a couple of years that we control the number of predators, coyotes, bears, cougars, specifically cougars, in the Bookcliffs, until a Bookcliff unit reaches or exceeds its objective, because we've been slow, the slowest unit in the state, I believe, in our deer herd recovery. I'm seeing some improvement. There's more deer does with two fawns coming off the summer range, and I run multiple trail cameras in the Bookcliffs year-round. I'm getting less cougar pictures, so I know that that's objective hunt is working. I'd like to recommend that the DWR continue that objective hunt at least for another year and until the deer herd unit has reached and exceeded its objective. Thank you.
Thank you, JC. Any other comments? Okay, discussion by the rack. Well, I'll entertain a motion. Anyone make that motion?
He came all the way here to say something, and he didn't realize he was supposed to comment.
I don't know. Are we till the end or not?
No, get up. Just get up, state your name.
I'm Roddy Smith. I'm representing the Utah Houndsman Association. Houndsman Association has reviewed the 2017 recommendations and appears to be following the current management plan, and we support this recommendation.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming tonight, too.
I got a quick question. So as far as JC, are you going to continue that objective out in the Bookcliffs, or where are you at on that?
That's the recommendation, is to maintain it as it was last year.
Okay, so if we make the motion to accept as approved,
mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
That'll work your way? I'll make the motion that we accept the DWR's proposal as presented.
Thank you, Mitch. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Thank you, David. All in favor? 7. Unanimous. Thank you, Leslie.
Yay.
That's the first time I've seen JC Brewer get his way.
I usually get mad and bawl or something.
I figured something had to be wrong.
Thank you all. I appreciate it.
Jenny, we'll turn some time for you. If you want to come up and talk about the proposed fee schedule. Jenny Johnson is our administrative section chief.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try not to poke fun at Boyd's memory. Okay, so I'm Kenny Johnson, the Admin Services Chief from Salt Lake City. Tonight we're going to talk about a few proposed fee changes. Really, there's three categories to think about. A couple of reductions, a couple of increases, and then some potential for some new opportunity for the public. So we will be pretty brief. I don't think I have more than four or five slides, so we'll just jump right into them here. I think most of the room is probably familiar with the fee change process. So the proposals first come to the RACs and the Wildlife Board. Anything that gets through the public process goes to the governor's office for a review and recommendation to the legislature. And then up at the legislature, we work through our Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee, and then they either approve or can modify or reject the proposal. Any fees that make it through the committee then get incorporated into the annual appropriation bill, which is voted on by all the legislators. And then any fees that make it that far become effective the beginning of the next fiscal year. So stuff we're talking about tonight would become active July 1st, 2017, so about a year from right now. So it's kind of a arduous, long process, and we'll get into a little bit more of that in the next couple of slides here. The impacts this time around are really minimal. Being funded primarily with sportsmen's dollars, hunters and anglers' dollars, we really do just try to balance fees with managing the increasing costs of protecting fish and wildlife. And so that's kind of the bottom line of what we do. Sometimes we'll propose fee changes to make some strategic changes, maybe to recruit and retain, reactivate anglers and hunters. And you'll see a couple of those tonight, maybe. And then for now, this is pretty minor, and the revenue generated by this potentially looks pretty small too this year. So let's jump right into the fees. The first one we're proposing is getting more kids out in the field hunting turkeys on the general season. Those have been pretty stagnant to maybe even declining a little bit. And so what we're going to propose as a recruitment tool is reducing turkey permit for youth from $35 down to $25. And that reduction in revenue is kind of a worst case projection. It's worst case if nothing else changes and all the same applicants stay the same, we'd stand to lose a little bit of revenue, about $20,000 in revenue. So that's roughly a 29-30% decrease. So to break even, we'd need to recruit about that many more young hunters. And so that might take a couple years to do, but that's the idea, just to get them excited and being able to hunt turkeys young. We've got a lot of families with multiple turkey hunters, and this will probably give mom and dad a little bit of a break in the pocketbook. So we support this one. This one is kind of a housekeeping item. This is a multi-season deer permit. So maybe imagine the Henry Mountains or the Book Cliffs out here. When we changed fees previously, we just kind of overlooked this one. I don't know if we didn't have the concept dialed yet or we just missed it, but we want to update it. So imagine hunting all three seasons on the Henry Mountains, getting archery, muzzleloader, and rifle hunting opportunity. We didn't have a fee for that. So right now we offer the permit, but we're only charging the single season fee. So kind of as a by housekeeping, we want to update and add a fee for both the premium units and the limited entry units. So those next couple of bullet points there. On the resident premium multi-season hunt, we're asking for an increase from $168 to $305 for residents. for non-residents from 568 to 1,025, and then from just our limited entry seasons, that resident limited entry multi-season from 80 up to $145, and on the non-resident side of that one from 468 to 845. So we think just inherently the value of those is better, and we just want to kind of strike a balance and charge a fair price for those, and just a tiny amount of revenue generated by that. And you're all welcome for that picture. I was going to take it out, but it survived. Boyd, is that?
That's Jim Karpowitz, who directs you in
about 10-15 years ago. Very astute observation.
That's that McFarland fella, isn't it?
I put it in there as a joke. I didn't think anyone would let me keep it in there, and they loved it, so I left it.
Yeah. I didn't dare say anything. I let it be one of your people, and they'd get a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that scene, right? The roadkill. Sorry, got off on a tangent there.
Just see if he's paying attention.
That's right. That's right. So this next one is one of the opportunities we talked about being a potential program in the future. And what it is, it's really just a three-season opportunity for general season elk hunters. So being able to purchase a tag that lets you hunt archery, muzzleloader, and rifle for general season elk. And tonight, you know, we really don't have any idea what this could look like in the future, the rules, the, you know, any of that. This is really just to establish the fee, since it takes so long to get the fee on the books. We would anticipate filling up the details and rule and bringing that out back out through the racks for you guys to kind of see and mm-hmm. approve in the future. So tonight it's just the idea to have that permit available. And what we're proposing is for residents, $150 for that three-season opportunity, and for non-residents, $700 for that permit. That almost second to last bullet there, antlerless elk mitigation, we're proposing a reduction there from 50 to 30, and that's to kind of bring us more in line with kind of our antlerless control opportunities that are out there now. So we're proposing a reduction to kind of bring those back down a little bit. And overall, we're projecting a slight increase of revenue in that elk world of about $90,000. Lastly, I believe this is the last one. So for division-sponsored events, what we want to do is propose being able to put on programs, whether it be hunting or fishing or watching-related, those outreach-type programs. We just want to be able to... You know, if we have supplies and materials that cost money, be able to charge participants just enough of a registration fee to cover those actual costs. So not make money, but just cover the cost to run those programs. So, you know, shooting sports, paying for some ammo, some targets, something like that, fishing, same kind of thing. So we're just going to ask the legislature for a little bit of flexibility in allowing us to cover those actual costs. That second bullet point, this is a really limited opportunity right now in the state. I believe that the only place we're allowing RV camping that's improved at all is on the Lee K range up in Salt Lake City on 21st South. There's a couple of RV pads with some power hookups there, and we don't have a fee for it. And so what we're doing is proposing a little bit of a range there that we can add this to the fee schedule and then maybe not look at it for 20 more years, just keep that nightly fee somewhere between $10 and $50 depending on what the demand is for it. And right now it's super low. And so we estimate program revenue, primarily that last bullet point, it might bring us $10,000, $11,000 to cover the actual cost of some of those recruitment programs. So in summary, really just a few things, maybe a new opportunity, maybe it helps us recruit and retain a few more young turkey hunters and then provide a little bit of revenue to manage wildlife. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. Question, Brother Rapid?
I've got one. You know me. On these and I don't know much about it. Maybe you enlighten me. On this shed hung, has it got to the point where they're issuing permits for that yet, or is that something that's going to be in the future? Because
it gets talked about a lot. We're not proposing anything now.
Well, it's quite popular. Isn't it causing a little bit of expense for the DWR?
Yeah, I think it probably does and puts pressure on a lot of those more popular units kind of year-round. But
a little more patrolling. So it would be possible probably a permit with a fee associated to it, you know, in the future, I guess.
Could definitely be in the future, yeah. We're not proposing it certainly tonight, but yeah,
no,
it's definitely
just
an option.
Information.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't know if it, you know, just
doesn't take a. You have to pass the test now. There's a little online course you gotta take to gather antlers at certain times of the year, a little more critical times of the year. But no fee associated with it as of right now.
No thing about it. I think a lot of these people make a little money.
I know I lose a lot of money trying to do it. But.
I know it's getting pretty popular and people make money. And
yeah, that's a fair question. It's a good question.
Raises hell with the animals out there, too.
Any other questions?
Just a quick question before you can answer. Is there a law that states that this various states have to stay within a... I mean, one state can't ask, like, $1,000 for a tag and... Do all the states have to stay within a relatively close amount to each other?
There's no real laws governing that. It's just, yeah, it's more just, yeah. Yeah, and each state's a little bit different. They're all kind of unique. You know, Utah's, we're heavily slanted to residents. We've got a lot more residents that participate than some of the surrounding states. They have a lot more non-residents. And so, really, I think every state's kind of in the same conundrum, just trying to raise enough revenue to manage their wildlife and not try to gouge sportsmen, because we, you know, we definitely know that that's where our bread is buttered and definitely appreciate that. So.
I saw that one slide where you're lowering the youth resident turkey tag. Is the adult tag, is it $35 too?
Yeah.
It is.
Yep, everybody's 35 right now, so we're just going to we're trying to get a little bit of a break so that families with multiple turkey hunters don't get hit quite as hard in the spring as they are maybe right now. So.
I guess I would wonder why you'd lower the cow out tags at $50. They're pretty reasonable. And so are people unhappy with that rate? Because I think that's real fair. And so to cost yourself revenue, unless you're expecting to sell more tags because of that. I guess I'd ask why would you just, if something's reasonable, why are we looking to cut it?
I think for that one, it's more the kind of opportunity that it is. It's, I don't know if it's all problem elk, but it's elk we need removed and usually can't get public access into some of it. And so I don't know that it's being complained about a lot either way. It just, this puts us in more in line with kind of that antlerless control tag, which is $30.
Which are probably too cheap, yeah.
Kind of a similar, yeah, so yeah. That's a fair question.
So anyway, that'd be my recommendation. It's already really reasonable.
Okay.
So it costs you money.
I've got a question. Okay, going back to the elk gathering antler, I know before it really got big, they used to cut it off from a period to a period. I'd like to see that happen again, because there's people going out there and stringing chicken wire and rope and everything just to knock these horns off. You know, and they're doing more damage than anything to the land out there when that land's wet, and they got these four-wheelers and just four-wheel drives tearing everything up. Because the tribe, we went back to from April 1st to December 1st. After that, we shut it out. You know, we went to that this year because of that fact, because people are getting stupid.
Yeah, and I think that's what the aim of the little online test, the aptitude test thing you have to take, it tries to get at some of those ethical kinds of situations out there and help people do that a little bit smarter. So it's I think it's tough to restrict access and say you can't pick up an antler any time of the year, but this was kind of step one to see if we could help those that were already doing it do it a little smarter.
Is it working?
I think probably keeps the honest people honest.
That man right there over there, he can make it work. He can take their horns from them and slide them.
That's
what we do.
Yep.
Other questions?
I've got one. When is the appropriate meeting to have that discussion?
I don't know.
Would it
be the big game stuff in November?
November.
November.
Yes.
Yeah, that would probably be the best time when we're talking about big game recommendations. November.
You know, just to finish that question, it's something that we could certainly put on the action log and ask. That's a fee structure like Mitch talked about, if there's a fee structure possible or if there's other ideas to help regulate shed hunting better. But so far, there hasn't been a really good way to do that. So I don't
season
know.
Days.
We tried
not
to do that. We tried to do that a couple of years ago and didn't get any traction. And in fact, there was many that were come out against it at that time. It may change.
Well, what the question would be then, there's some areas in the state that do have season dates, right?
Montana. For antler gathering?
Yeah. Montana is one of them.
There's certain areas.
But we're just talking about bees. That's it right now.
Yeah.
There's certain areas like the habitat units, like Middle Fork, the Ogden, and that, where they don't allow it until a certain date. And then everybody runs in there on the same day.
And it's all on public.
That's
public lands.
That's an area closure more so than it is a season on shed antlers. It
right.
De facto becomes a.
Nobody
can
do it because
you can't go in there.
Wyoming has a shed season, and I don't know that it's done anything to
help that situation.
Protect it. You know, there's a lot of talk if you listen to all sides, and I don't know that anything's come up, like Boyd said, that really has gained any traction at all. But as far as just a fee that Mitch, I mean, that's what was proposed was. Mitch said, is there a way to look at a fee? I guess the only way to do that would be to put it on an action log and have you kind of develop some proposed fee schedule that we could all look at and then decide whether that's worth taking out to the rats.
Yeah, that'd probably be the best place to start. And that'd give us some time to do some homework on, you know, what we're up against enforcement-wise and what our costs are to manage it and all that. So it's probably a good place to start.
But yeah, you know, if you've got expenses because of, which I'm sure you do, boy, that, I think, would legitimize your fee proposal.
And you have a lot of law enforcement and biologists that time of year out there, right? Doing postseason counts and stuff like that. We're out anyways.
You're not supposed to say that. Haven't you read Trump's book yet?
We're all
the yard the deal. Yeah. Yard for the deal.
Questions by the public? Comments, by the way. Do you have any comment cards? Discussion. Mm-hmm. Well, anybody have a motion or two?
I motion that we go ahead and accept the proposed fee schedule as presented.
Okay, thank you, David. Do we have a second?
Yeah, I'll second that.
Dan seconds that. All in favor of that motion? 7 unanimous.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I propose that we adjourn the rat.
Wow. Okay.
Is it that?
There you go. That was David. We have a second?
I'll second it.
Yeah, Dan will second. All in favor?
How about discussion? Are we done?
I guess we're done.
What do you have discussion on that?
Are we done?
Thanks, guys. I appreciate y'all coming.